I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Well, some things never change. In America today, parents of a young man or woman can get lost in the fantasy that he or she will grow up to be a famous athlete, a golfer, a basketball star, a tennis player. Fame, glory, and oh, those endorsements. 2,500 years ago, when a baby boy was born in ancient Greece, the parents would hang an olive wreath outside the door. Well, first to announce the birth, but also in hopes that the child would grow up to be an athlete, to win a laurel wreath in the competitions at Olympus. And the same hopes were there. Fame, glory, and yes, even endorsements. This summer, when the games open in Athens, they're meant to reflect back on the birth of the modern Olympics some 100 years ago. But the origins of the games actually go back much further, almost 2,800 years. This hour, we'll consider those early competitions, in part to see what of them remains in the modern games, but also because of the light they shed on the people, the past times, and the preoccupations of ancient Greece. There are also some really good stories to tell, and we'll get to those. As always, we'd like to hear from you. Which lessons from the ancients would you like to see imported into the 21st century competitions? Which ones are you grateful to have relegated to a distant, distant past? Do the Olympics still possess the symbolic importance they once did? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Helping us for this program, we have here in our Boston studio Christine Condoli, and she is curator of Greek and Roman art at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston. She is the co-curator of Games for the Gods, the Greek Athlete and the Olympic Spirit, which in fact is opening next Wednesday. And Christine, as I said, is here in our Boston studio. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
I should tell our listeners, too, that they can get a sneak preview at least a couple of things that are going to be in the exhibit by going to our website. We are at theconnection.org, and we have a photo gallery of some of the material that will be on display at the MFA. Joining us from NPR in New York, Thomas Cahill. Thomas is author of the Hinges of History series about Western civilization. His latest book is Sailing the Wine Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter. Thomas, thanks for being with us.
Dick, thank you for inviting me.
Can I start with you, Thomas? Because one of the most visually striking aspects of the original games is that nobody's wearing any clothes. Why is that?
Well, it's visually striking to us, I guess, more so than it was to them, since they were quite used to it. It's not a simple question or a simple answer. Certainly, the surrounding cultures were even more upset by the nudity than we would be. They found it peculiar and degenerate in many ways, and the Greeks didn't see it that way at all. I think that it's what the great difficulty is to try to decide, did nudity begin in life first or in art first? And there's no way of absolutely answering that question, but it seems as if the Greeks from a very early date were pretty casual about clothes, and their art suggests almost from the beginning that they see the human ideal in such a way that it must be presented as a nude human body. They are thinking always about the ideal and the real and the difference between them. And as their art takes off, especially in the 6th and 5th centuries, the ability to portray a human being, particularly in this case, to begin with, a male human being, at the very peak of his beauty, is their way of presenting the human ideal. It's not simply an ideal. It's also a kind of tragedy. There's a kind of sadness in it, because part of what you're supposed to think when you look at those statues is to say, yes, you look great at 19. What will you look like at 57? And you are supposed to realize that this perfection is something passing. And therefore, though it's a kind of glorious art, it's also a sad art.
Was the beauty then, Christine, of the male body in the original games a part of the competition?
Well, there are two ways of going about this. First, yes, specifically there was a male beauty contest held in Athens, specifically for the Panathenaic Games, and I would imagine...
No swimsuit competition.
No.
Okay.
All buff. But that's very specific to Athens. The Crown Games, which we want to speak about probably and focus on, as the exhibition does focus on, does celebrate nudity and, in fact, demand nude competition. And I would suggest, and a lot of scholars debate this endlessly, but I would suggest, and more scholars, I think, are coming to this way of thinking, that the nudity, in fact, is a kind of state of ritual purity, and that these individuals, the males, of course, the games were exclusively open to free male Greek citizens, was a way of leveling the playing field, if you will. They all present themselves equally, so it's almost a kind of democratic presentation. They open themselves to flogging if they do commit fouls, so that in that sense also a free citizen, even an aristocratic citizen, allowing an individual to flog him, for instance, is a very democratic statement, if you will. They're all there together, nude. And also, these were age classes that competed. So
not weight classes as we know them today.
Classes. Exactly, Dick. So age classes. So they're grouped according to their ages. Boys at 12, adolescents at the ages of, say, when they're just getting their hair at 15, and you can identify the age classes in the artwork by the presence of body hair.
Right.
And finally, the bearded ones, the men, the andres, after 18, age 18. The fact that they're divided into age classes suggests very much to me and to other scholars that that is, in fact, a kind of explanation, if you will, of the nudity, that they are being initiated from boyhood into manhood, into society. And the very fact that they prepared for the games by 30 days of abstinence from sexual contact, male or female,
right.
And that they didn't, they had a very strict diet beforehand, and they were very much held in seclusion for those 30 days in the neighboring town of Elis near Olympia, would again suggest this idea of initiation.
Okay, but Thomas, if in fact it was meant to be at least partly, meant to be a competition for upper-class, well-built Greek males. There are stories of people who snuck in who weren't supposed to be there, like cooks and shepherds, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, always. In fact, one of the great stories of the first modern Olympics, which was, of course, held in Athens, is that a Greek shepherd slipped into the marathon race and won it on behalf of Greece, which became, you know, one of the great modern athletic moments, certainly for the Greeks, but I think really for the Olympic competition as a whole. So, and the Greeks were quite aware of the fact that this was a kind of revenant moment, a coming back of something that had happened long ago.
What's the connection?
They got a huge kick out of it.
What's the connection between the gods and the games? In if we go back to the original intention, because
most of the things that the Greeks did were done in a religious context, which to us sometimes doesn't look terribly religious because the actual things they were doing we think of as secular, athletics, theater. Even a good party began with the pouring of a libation to a god and a dithyram or a kind of sequential poem and song in which everybody processed around in honor of that god. It might have looked more to us like a conga line than like religious ritual, but the Greeks didn't make such a division between sacred and profane as we do. They kind of mixed it all up, and every single athletic competition was in honor of some god. And of course, at the Olympics, the great god was Zeus, who was the great god of the Greeks. But there were other competitions that were in honor of other gods.
Okay, I want to go back.
They always start that way. They always start with prayers and hymns. And they always end that way.
Christine, 1776 BC, my little piece of paper here.
776,
tells me,
excuse
me. Sorry, thank you very much. The other one sort of stuck in my head for other reasons. 776 BC, the first Olympic Games proclaimed by King Iphitos of Elis, acting on the instructions of the Delphic Oracle and so on and so forth. But weren't there games that were actually played on the battlefields of Troy, which may have preceded that? Where do we mark the very first sort of Olympic competition, if we call it that?
Well, good question. And again, a scholarly debate ensues and is not settled, but Book 23 of the Iliad by Homer tells us that Achilles' beloved friend Patroclus dies and he wants to honor him as befitting a hero, and he does it outside the walls of Troy with chariot racing, wrestling, foot races, a lot of the events that slowly make their way into the crown games, as we call them, the religious festival games. And these events, the victors of these events are honored with prizes. That's the difference. In the games of the Iliad, in Book 23, the winners get tripods, bronze tripods, gold bowls, women, horses, valuable prizes. But the games, as they come to be called, the crown games, those religious festival games, the winners are only given leafy crowns, the crown of olive, the crown of laurel, the crown of pine, the crown of celery.
What was the point behind that? Why did they want to remove some kind of cash or worldly prize for a winner?
We don't really know the motivation, but we can extrapolate that these, again, were very religious events, that you are shown favor by the gods by winning, and that in itself was the greatest honor. And in fact, we come back to the notion of arete, or virtue, and virtue through perfection. And this is this concept that I know Mr. Cahill's written quite a bit about, but the kaloi ke agathoi, the beautiful and the good, that you become a reflection, if you will, of the gods, and you have a kind of heroic status. And indeed, when these victors went back to their hometowns, they were honored. In some cases, homes were built for them. They got free meals for life in
Athens. So the endorsements came back when you went back home.
And you could compete repeatedly. Later, of course, many games are initiated at various towns and cities throughout the Mediterranean world where cash rewards are given. They're smaller games, and right. In order to attract the great athletes, they do give cash rewards. But those initial festivals, particularly Olympia, which is the most important and prestigious, they only gave the crowns. So this does differ from Book 23 of the Iliad, but it does seem that originally these games were probably games to honor dead heroes, battlefield heroes.
All right, so if the winner, hang on just half a second, Thomas, we have to take a short break here. If the winner gets a laurel of pine, what does second place get? What does third place get in the original games? And what do we see in the games that we understand today, in the ones which were, in fact, played out 2,800 years ago? We'll continue that conversation when we come back after the break. We'd like to have you with us. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me on the program this hour, Christine Kondolian. She is co-curator of Games for the Gods, The Greek Athlete and the Olympic Spirit. It's an exhibition of vases, bronzes, and what we might call ancient sports memorabilia, opening next week at the MFA in Boston. You can see some of the images on our website. We're at theconnection.org. And Thomas Cahill is also with us. He's the author of the Hinges of History series about Western civilization, one of which, the most recent, Sailing the Wine Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK, and we're going to take our first call from Pittsboro, North Carolina. It's Jim with us on the line. Hi, Jim.
Morning. Say, I'm going to be taking a 14-year-old granddaughter to the Olympics, and naturally I want her to be favorably impressed and even thrilled. But there has been a lot of talk of corruption in regarding doping and some corruption of officials in recent Olympics and so on. Of course, the Olympics, I gather, were not perfect when they were first done in Greece. Question, have we advanced far, if at all, in that regard, or in regard to purity, or are we about where we were then?
Thomas, Thanks. Do we need to hear about Nero here?
Well, Nero... Nero really corrupted the games, but that was at a much later date. He was, of course, the Roman emperor, and he was, I think, the world's most famous spoiled brat, and he insisted upon competing, but not only on competing, but changing the time of the games, which was a kind of heresy, and then he insisted on winning every game that he entered. And the Greeks really thought this was... this was very, very bad stuff. They didn't like it at all. Going back to this thing about why they didn't give cash as a prize.
Yeah.
These were games for gentlemen. The gentlemen didn't require cash. All they wanted was honor. So anyone like Nero showing up really created a kind of negative sensation. And of course there was always corruption because there were human beings involved, and that hasn't changed, and I don't think it can. Though I would say on behalf of the Greek Games this summer that I think they've done an incredible job. Greece is a tiny country. It's 5 million people. Athens, a century and a half ago, was basically a shepherd's village. The Greeks have done a wonderful job of transforming Athens, not just for the games, but for themselves and for the future. I think they are to be applauded.
Three cheers. I agree.
Jim, you should be pleased that most of the athletes will be wearing clothes at these Olympic Games. It'll be easier for you with your 14-year-old granddaughter.
If you have a second, do you think we ought to go back to amateur athletes in the Olympics, or are we better off with professional and amateur?
I don't know, Christine, that the Greeks wouldn't kind of admire the principle of the Olympics today that does set aside the difference between amateur and professional and simply honors the very best.
I think that they were very much about professionalism. They worked very hard at the games. And in fact, a number of the objects that I hope your listeners will come and see show very young boys training with punch bags, boxing punch bags and dumbbells, and boys that, you know, judging by their bellies and their toes, might be as little as 4 or 5 years old. So this was a very serious endeavor for the Greek free male citizenry, and they spent a lot of money, those who could afford it, hiring trainers, which is a kind of professionalism that occurred in the gymnasium and the palestra. So I would agree that it's not as amateur as we'd like to reflect back and assume, but it was for honor that they competed and for the glory that came to them as favored by the gods. But I might like to add something about the 14-year-old girl going to the games. We're not quite sure whether young women did go to the games, but we're divided about that, and some of us believe the 14-year-old girls did indeed go with fathers, grandfathers, and brothers. Certainly, married women were not allowed, on pain of death, to be spectators at
the games. Weren't there some women who competed in some of the athletic competitions?
In the Greek time, absolutely not. We have women victors, for instance, in 392 and 398, a woman named Kyneska gets victory prize for her chariot racing. But she herself wasn't the charioteer. She, through her wealth, owned a chariot and horses, and she won in that way, but not competing directly herself.
Thomas?
Well, because none of the people who owned horses competed directly, whether they were male or female. But I thought that there was one. I mean, there are Greek statues of girls running, and it seems that they did compete in some foot race.
Well, they competed in a religious race exclusively for females for the goddess Hera at the Temple of Hera at Olympia. This has nothing to do with the crown games, however. They were not allowed into those games.
It was, I guess, Thomas...
But they were sometimes allowed to run. That was the only point I wanted to make.
No, fair enough.
Every once in a while they could.
It sounds
do
like it was a good time, Thomas, to be an alpha male in that country at that time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, Greece was, the Greeks were the world's first sports fans, but they were also a society of alpha males. If you wanted to go back in history and if you wanted to be a part of Greece, what you definitely would want to was to have been born as a well-born Greek male. And then you would have had it made in the shade. But virtually any other category of human being would have been considerably less desirable. God help you if you turned out to be a slave. But women didn't, in general, fare very well either.
Well, you would have had it made in the shade. That brings up a very important point. How did they compete in the nude out in the burning hot sun of early August, which is when they did compete? One of the things that we might find very different, aside from nudity, was that they rubbed themselves with olive oil to protect their skin from sunburn, as they believed it, and to protect them from the pores from dirt. And this seems to be a ritual, well, not even a ritual, a practical hygiene matter. And we often identify the athletes in art by the fact that they hold these tiny little oil jars around leather thongs around their wrists. And these oil jars identify them as athletes, and sometimes they come in the form of something as masculine as a phallic ceramic jar that they hold. So we see how much all of this is about being male.
Did they use the olive oil for contact sports like a wrestling, though? It sure changed that sport.
Mm-hmm. They did, but they rubbed themselves with dust or dirt, and then they went into the wrestling match. And I think the closest thing we know of this is the mud wrestling that goes on in Thrace today still. It was a pretty sweaty, dirty mess, and afterwards they scraped themselves with bronze scrapers.
In fact, it is what we see in some of the images the exhibit that you've pulled together, that the scrapers mm-hmm. and the different kinds mm-hmm. of discus. How much do we learn about the Greek games from the artwork that they left behind?
An immense amount, and I think that it's interesting because there are a lot of texts. So clearly there was a huge interest on the part of the contemporary Greeks in writing about athletics. They had treatises on gymnastics. Aristotle wrote Philostratus. A lot of Plato, of course, wrote. Mm-hmm. He himself was a wrestler. But the artifacts themselves speak volumes, more in some cases than the texts. For instance, we have a discus, a marble discus in the exhibition, that it reads, "From the funeral mound." Well, in fact, that tells us that they had commemorations and commemorative games at the burial areas in imitation of the actual game. So that speaks to us about this. Some objects reveal a pentathlete's burial mound, and you would see his javelins, his discus, his jumping weights to honor him at his burial. So you start to learn a lot about their traditions from these small objects.
1-800-423-8255. We're going to Greensboro, North Carolina next. Jonathan's with us. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. I had a question for your guests regarding how much we know about the ancient Olympic Games and how good the athletes were at their various sports. Are we able to, know how good they are and be able to compare them to athletes of today, or were they just competing against each other and we only know who won and lost certain competitions?
They took this, Thomas, pretty seriously. We know that much, right?
Yes, they did. There would be many similarities to our games and many differences. I think we would be surprised to find that measurement of the course and things like that were probably a little iffy. We would be much, much more concerned about getting that kind of thing right. As Christine pointed out earlier, the dividing line between amateur and professional was as elastic then as it is now, maybe elastic in different ways. The world was much smaller in the sense that there were far fewer people in it. That in itself creates different levels of competition. But at least in the Greek world, the Olympics were thought of as an international event. You couldn't compete if you didn't know Greek, God help you. If you didn't know Greek, you couldn't get anywhere near the games. But there were people from all over the known world, from Greek settlements throughout the known world, who would come to Olympia to compete.
So like we have nation states today, they had city states competing then?
They did, but all of those people together in one place – We have to imagine also what it looked like. I think Christine mentioned the sunlight, which of course beats down in Greece in a way that it doesn't. It's the most sunny country in Europe, and one of the most important professions was the profession of tent maker and pavilion maker. These games were filled with canvas, colored canvas overhead to keep people, to enable people to have some shade. And it also created a kind of circus atmosphere. It was to come from your little village to Olympia in the middle of the games would have been so immensely exciting.
I'd like to just add that, of course, all of that's true, and thank you for painting that very vivid picture for us. But just to the mundane here, there were no stopwatches. There was no standardized foot. The human foot was the measurement of, for instance, the stadium. Our measurement of stadium, our word stadium, in fact, comes from their stade or foot race, which was 600 feet, 200-yard dash. But that varied from city to city, from religious site to religious site. So how standardized could this be? There were no records kept, just to answer the caller's question very specifically here. However, they measured time by the Olympiad. So the Olympic winners gave their names to the victors, gave their names to that particular cycle of time.
You've reminded me of something which I left hanging. Thomas, help us with this. The silver and the bronze medal winners from those original games, what did they get?
Well, at Olympia, they got an olive branch, a sort of olive crown to wear on their heads. That's what I guess we would call the gold medal winner got. I'm not sure, Christine, what did the lesser winners get? I know that the losers got nothing. They got Zippo. And in fact, that was very important to the Greeks, that someone always win and someone always lose. And they made everything into a competition, not just athletics. I mean, theater was a competition and poetry reading was a competition and music and even telling jokes at a party became a competition.
And drinking.
There was very little in their life that was not part of a competition.
Did they have second and third places, though, Christine?
They absolutely did not for those crown games. They received, as you said, Thomas, the crown. They were intensely competitive. The word athlete, in fact, means one who competes for a prize. So that's very specifically what they're doing, is competing for a prize. But there was only the winner. That's all.
Okay.
You had to be victor.
Right.
And anything less than that, and that is a huge difference, isn't it, between our time and theirs. Just competing wasn't good enough. In fact, if you competed and you lost, you were in disgrace. So the very fact that you would be willing to compete was hugely brave of you in that society.
the minivans all over the country with the mothers over the ears of their children. It's not whether you win or lose. It's just
that.
1-800-423-8255.
That was not one of their sayings.
No, not something handed down.
Where were the mothers? That's what
Des Moines, Iowa. Tom's joining us. Hi, Tom.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I have a question. With the whole deal with doping and dietary supplements, with the Olympics today, I was curious, was there any kind of dietary advantage that the athletes took back then besides just eating healthy foods?
Mm.
Maybe the guys who didn't show up hungover was part of it. I don't know.
Yeah. There were some issues about that.
They did
have strict diet regimes, those 30 days of seclusion that I mentioned before. And we do have in the various treatises dietary suggestions on the part of medical treatises like Galen and Hippocrates, right, about this. And they preferred high-protein diets for their athletes. And since there wasn't that much meat available, it was often restricted for the towns and cities' great athletes. And this seems to be extrapolation from the text. They would mix meats, goat, beef, cow, goat, whatever, that sort of meat with barley. But they preferred
sort
high protein.
Sort of an Atkins thing
Atkins thing happening. Because most of the people did live on oil, breads, and vegetables.
Thomas, was there any room, if in fact it was a culture of competition, was there any allowance made for cheating, honorable cheating, dishonorable cheating? I mean, I don't know if doping would be a... Of course, it would be considered a part of that. But overall,
well, I mean, there were rules for everything. There were rules for conduct in battle. There were rules for how you put on a play. And if you didn't do it the right way, you were in pretty hot water. I mean, you were really disgraced. So it was very much a shame culture, and a large part of any human being's life was spent in avoiding shame.
Let's bring that back.
you would be pretty. It's not the sort of thing that anyone with a brain in his head would have indulged in, and so there wasn't all that much of it.
We do have a few stories of cheating, but I agree with Thomas, it was quite rare. There's, for instance, a runner from Croton, Ostulos, who was bribed to run not from Croton, which is in southern Italy, but from Syracuse, which is in Sicily. And, of course, his fellow citizens in Croton were so angered they tore down his house, his statue.
So he was bribed to run for the competition.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
But that's what you get for doing things like that. You don't come out well in the end.
That's
there are a
right.
lot more stories of people who couldn't go without sex for 30 days.
and so
I haven't collected those. I'm eager to read your compendium.
I mean, that was a rule that was often broken. So
there's lots of discussion about that. It's quite interesting because it relates to the olive oil. You can see I'm fascinated by the olive oil. They believe that if they sweat or if they lose bodily liquids through sexual activity, that they would deplete their strength. And this is just, an early concept of the body.
All right, Connection listeners, which games sound like more fun? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We are talking about a comparison between the games as we know them today and the athletes and the organizers of the original games 25, 26, 2700 years ago. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking about the Olympics then and the Olympics now. We'd like to hear from you. We're going to start with a call in Buffalo, New York. Alice is with us. Hi, Alice.
Hi, thank you. I'm very old and just making an observation, but it seems to me they were proving their maleness and their superiority as a male and very exclusive. And today they're more inclusive. And even Special Olympics for the handicapped. So I think they've become better and broader, but also there was no politics involved then, I don't think, and now there is.
I'm not sure about the political side. Let's set that aside for just a minute, Christine, the idea of proving one's manhood. I mean, how closely linked is that to being, the fastest or the strongest or jumping the highest?
Well, I think I'll take it a little broader. I think you're right. The caller is absolutely right that it's much more inclusive. And one of the things we do in the exhibition is to connect to images of today's Olympians and their beautiful performances. And we purposely show both in the catalog and the exhibition many women competing and many African Americans competing. So you see that difference right away in that inclusiveness in today's society as opposed to the very exclusive male free citizen body of the Greek games. You're quite right that they are proving their malehood, their maleness and the perfection of that body. I would say that one of the discoveries for me in putting this exhibition together with my colleague John Herman at the MFA was to look around the landscape of art, Greek art, in museums and indeed throughout the world where it's populated by the Greek male nude, which becomes a kind of commonplace and you take it for granted. But in fact, through the lens of Greek athletics, you realize that these are not just male nudes that you're looking at or just the idealization of the Greek body that they're promoting. But in fact, these people have identities. They're actually athletes, and they are victors, and they are honored by their society for a specific type of activity, athletic competition.
Thomas, I don't know if you've seen some of them. Of course you have, because you use some of them in your book. But, the size of the thighs on these guys, they're enormous.
Thunder thighs.
I mean, that speaks, I guess, in part to the type of events that they were competing in, or the fact that they spend all their time going up and down mountainsides.
Well, the body is definitely different from our ideal. Their ideal is different. You know, it's ours requires a thinner waist, for one thing, not just the, you know, and the thighs are usually larger and the waist is usually thicker. So there are a number of ways in which they are different. Of course, we know from the bodies that have been dug up that very few Greeks actually looked this way. But
it's like somebody going through Vogue magazine 100 years from now. Going,
well, not unlike.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I facetiously call this the Buns of Steel exhibition, and it's indeed true that they are remarkable bodies, and I think that will excite many people who come to see them and they admire them. But what's fascinating is, as you look closely at them, and it does demand some close looking, the artists did differentiate the body types depending on the activities, the different competitions. Mm. So the runners are differentiated from the wrestlers. The wrestlers tend to have very big paunches and very thick necks, and they seem to have had different diets as well. So you can start to tell which parts of the body were worked up. There's some cross-pectoral muscles and diagonals that are developed for certain kinds of pentathletic.
But there's something
events.
Quite stylized, Christine, in the way that they're presented in
Absolutely.
The art. In some cases, you'll
Absolutely.
See a runner with both his arms up yes. in front of him, which you would never
yes.
never see. Is that, I mean, is how
yes,
do we make sense of that?
Yes, it's a very important correction. I'm glad you said that. These are naturalistic representations, as naturalistic as their art abilities allowed for at the time, but they're also very much idealized and they're very much codified in types. They're not portraits as such. And the artists within their range and their vocabulary of artistic ability present something that is believably a short-distance runner or a long-distance runner. A short-distance runner might use their arms as wings. A long-distance runner has a very steady gait, and the arms are held closer to the waist. So they do differentiate. They do try to be naturalistic in their representation. They're certainly not portraits. They're certainly not realistic.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Jamaica Plain next, and John's joining us. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you this
Fine.
Morning? I just wanted to know if there was any specific connection between the drama competitions that they had for Dionysus in Athens and the Olympic athletic connection competitions.
Thomas, was that
I don't
part?
Think there's,
yeah, go ahead.
I don't think there's a direct connection, but there are connections. Athletic games were held in many places. And, for instance, if you go to Delphi, which is where the great oracle was, really probably the most important religious shrine in all of Greece, in all of the ancient world in many ways. If you went there as a pilgrim, you would have bathed yourself in the salubrious spring. You would have made an offering to Apollo. You might have listened to an oracle from the god meant for yourself or for your village or the place that you came from. But you would also have participated very likely in races. There was an enormous race course there above the sanctuary. You would probably have participated in a theatrical event. There was a theater there. And all these things the Greeks thought of as therapeutic, as part of the good life.
What percentage of society, Thomas, when you talk about this sort of fabulous
10.
Life,
I mean, 10%, 15%,
sort of
maybe
like the
20.
Hamptons or what?
Yeah, they definitely.
You know, it was for the entitled Greek male.
Yeah.
Of course, women went to these sanctuaries as well. And there were rules, as Christine pointed out, about who could watch what and all that sort of stuff. Different people could participate in different ways according to their station, but it was only the entitled Greek male that got to go everywhere. But they did think of these things as forms of, just as we think of a gym as therapy, they did too. I mean, they are the original, they are the people who thought up the gymnasium as a form of therapy. But they also thought of prayer, washing, theater, all these things for them were forms of becoming healthier.
We're going to go next to Waltham, Massachusetts. Sarah's joining us. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thank you. I'd like to know something about the bearing of the torch. Did they have somebody running from country to country? And how did it begin? And is there a fire god?
There is. It was actually closer to competition than to the showy part that we now use to set up the Olympic Games of today. Isn't it, Christine?
Yes. The torch relay that Coubertin and, well, actually it started after the revival in 1896. The torch relay, as we've come to know it, is this very unifying global expression of peace, an announcement of the sport of the Olympics, was different. The torch relay was used only in Athens. It's not part of the competition of the crown games. And it was used in Athens to mark the start of the Panathenaic Festival with various tribe leaders, district leaders from Athens, each carrying the lit torch and relaying it to the next runner. And they carried it from one altar, the altar of Eros probably in the Lyceum, all the way to the altar of Athena on the Acropolis.
So was it for show or was it a competition? Were there different torch runners competing against one another?
It was a type of competition, but it isn't exactly the way we think of competition. It was a goal to keep the torch lit from one part of Athens to the Acropolis, and if you failed to do that, obviously there was disgrace, but it wasn't so much of a competition.
Okay, to Boston next. Jeff's with us. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, hey, Cambridge. One thing I always wondered in terms of the events that, you know, the nudity factor and out in the heat and the sun, and the guy, scholar here, mentioned elastic a few times, that just in terms of safety or, you get hurt. Isn't it painful, you know, to be... there was no safety protection.
Yeah, I don't know. Did they have hurdles? Did they have things that where they had to worry about that, Thomas?
I'm not sure. I don't remember hurdles in anything. Do you, Christine?
No hurdles, but they did ride bareback, and that certainly must have been quite painful. I shouldn't say, but
I think it's a good guess.
Yeah.
The only people who were dressed, let's qualify this, the only dressed competitors were the charioteers. And it's clear that they wore their cloaks because the chariot races were really dangerous. And it was more than likely the thrill of the spill, which made it the highlight event of Olympia. But that also implies that it was a very dangerous event. And sometimes you could have up to 40 chariots on a race course. The idea of a dragging nude body wasn't as far as they were willing to go. But everyone else was nude. All other males in competitions were nude. And there is some talk about infibulation, which was a process of protecting the genitals. And there are actually depictions of infibulation on some of the drinking vessels. Drinking vessels, people. Infibulation on drinking vessels.
Yeah, go ahead, Christine. Explain infibulation.
You cowardly males, you.
Well, I'm backing off because I have no idea what it is.
Read your anthropology text.
there's your weekend homework for you. We're going to Fitchburg, Massachusetts probably going to be our last call here. Aliki, hi.
Hello.
Yeah, you're on. What are you thinking?
Well, I was just, from everything that I have read and heard, the ancient Greeks, they used to eliminate all battles throughout the Greek Empire during the games. No fighting. And I would like to know if that really is true. And also, do you think that it would be possible in today's world to have such a wonderful thing happen? I think it would be terrific. But anyhow, that's
a very idealistic question. But Thomas, they did in fact try to, or did they manage to?
They
stop
did,
battles?
Though, as with everything else, they were never they were not always completely successful in that. And would it be possible to do in our world? Probably I'm sure it's more difficult in our world, a much bigger world, a much more difficult world in many ways. But that is certainly, I think, one of the ideals of the modern Olympics, is to create an alternative to war, to make competition non-lethal. And it may not have reached the point where that could actually happen, but it certainly is there as a symbol and as an ideal for us to think about and maybe someday pull off.
It's interesting, Christine, that one of the things that we can look back to on those original games is the importance that they placed on letting the best person win. Thomas was talking about how Nero came in and corrupted that. But if we, you know, to think back to a time when that was allowed to happen, when it wasn't always the emperor or some prince mm-hmm. or someone else who was handed some kind of victory, mm-hmm. that's not a bad idea that they left.
I totally agree. And I think that right now, as the caller points out, wouldn't it be great to think that we could achieve some sense of honor and peace in competition? And I think that we're reminded again that people can come together, can compete, can bring honor upon themselves, their hometowns, and indeed, as specimens of the human race, through honest competition, but also the achievement of arete, of virtue through excellence. I think this is a really wonderful bridge between us and the past.
I want to thank the two of you for coming in to help us with this bridge between the past and the games as we understand them today. Christine, thanks for being with us.
It's a delight.
Christine Kondolian is co-curator of Games for the Gods, the Greek Athlete, and the Olympic Spirit. It's at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, opening next week. Thomas Cahill, thanks a lot for your time.
Dick, thank you so much.
Thomas is author of the Hinges of History series. His most recent book is Sailing the Wine Dark Sea. What a great title. Sailing the Wine Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter. Just a reminder, you can find a gallery of images from the MFA's upcoming exhibition, as well as other relevant links on our website. We'll even put a definition on our website of infibrillation. Is that, have I pronounced it right?
Correct.
All right. Because we can't leave you completely at sea. Not a wine dark sea. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.